lay. KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Welcome to Native America Calling. I'm Sean Spruce. A move by Alberta's premier to potentially make separating from the rest of Canada easier has created an uproar, not least among Indigenous people in the province. However serious the suggestion, First Nations in Alberta held an emergency meeting to resist what they see as an incursion into their sovereignty and their interests in maintaining their relationship with the federal government. We'll explore the complex issue of provincial separation right after the news.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. A federal court has temporarily halted the federal government's plan to transfer Oak Flat, a tribal sacred site in Arizona, to Resolution Copper. The transfer was expected to take place as early as June. Apache Stronghold, a coalition of Apache people, other Native people, and non-Native allies, filed an emergency request to halt the transfer while the Supreme Court considers the case. That request was granted Friday. The coalition has been fighting the land transfer for years, saying the copper mine threatens religious freedom, while Resolution Copper has touted jobs and an economic impact. New Mexico and Colorado recently created alerts for missing Indigenous people. Now Arizona is poised to join them with its own turquoise alert. As Gabriel Pietrazio reports for the Mountain West News Bureau, a legislative bill awaits the governor's signature.
The House will now proceed to vote.
Had the turquoise alert already been law, Republican bill sponsor Teresa Martinez says it could have helped find 14-year-old San Carlos Apache Emily Pike.
Not only was she killed, but she was dismembered. And it breaks my heart that we, the state of Arizona, didn't even go looking for this little girl.
Another supporter is House Democrat Myron Soce from the Navajo Nation. He remembers 11-year-old Ashlyn Mike, who also went missing. Her 2016 death aided in bringing Amber Alerts to Indian Country.
This is for Shiyaja Emily Pike. This is for Shiyaja Ashlyn Mike and many others who are still missing. This is for you.
Gabriel Pietrazio, Phoenix.
Native experts in foraging for traditional foods are sharing some of their recommendations. Chuck Kornbach of Station WUWM reports.
In Papago Park, east of Phoenix, Twyla Cassador points to the base of a Palo Verde tree where small branches, dried leaves, and other plant matter have formed the ground nest of a desert wood rat. Cassador says the rodent is both a source of nutrition and knowledge.
And many of us may not think much about the desert wood rat, but as people that study environmental science or engineering, this friend of ours, also a delicious friend, will tell us about climate change.
Cassador is a traditional food forager and educator with the San Carlos Apache tribe. She explains to a tour organized by the Society of Environmental Journalists that other researchers have found that as the planet warms, the wood rat uses larger plant material to shade or insulate its home. But where the rat is plentiful, as it is here in the Sonoran Desert, it can also be a source of what Cassador calls pre-reservation food, food from before the years when the U.S. government forced Native people away from their longtime homes.
They took everyone away from the landscape where they originally foraged from and hunted from.
Helping Cassador with the effort to discover more traditional foods is Jeffrey Lazos Ferns, a naturalist and member of the Pascua Yaqui tribe. He points to blossoms and seeds on the Palo Verde tree.
These flowers, you can make tea out of them. Also, the pods, which you may be seeing some of the more younger trees out here, they taste like edamame, so you can eat them fresh off the tree. Or you can peel them, boil them, put salt on them, or store them for the season that you actually do want to use them.
Lazos Fern says some larger cities like Tucson have started to plant more indigenous plants that need less water or no fertilizer and be a source of food or medicine. For National Native News, I'm Chuck Kornbach.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
DT Track, your healthcare partner across Indian Country, supports this show. DT Track provides culturally competent nationwide healthcare staffing to IHS, tribal, and urban health facilities. More at dt-track.com.
Support for law and justice related programming provided by Hobbs, Strauss, Dean & Walker, LLP, a national law firm dedicated to promoting and defending tribal rights for over 40 years. More information available at HobbsStrauss.com.
Support by Siri, with a diverse and strategic investment portfolio for the long-term benefit of their shareholders. Investing in energy, infrastructure, real estate, government services, and more. Information is available at CIRI.com.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
This is Native America Calling. I'm Sean Spruce. Frustration with the federal government has boiled over in Alberta as the premier of that province is fueling discussions about separating from Canada. First Nations leaders quickly and forcefully expressed their opposition to that idea. There has been little to no conversation between the provincial government and Indigenous representatives as the talk of separation moves forward. Today, we're going to hear from Indigenous voices about what would be among the most consequential political actions in Canada's history. We're also going to get a perspective of what to expect from incoming Pope Leo from an Indigenous point of view. His predecessor made overtures to Canada's Indigenous people. Of course, we also want to hear from you, our listeners. Join our conversation today by calling in at 1-800-996-2848. 1-800-996-2848. Joining us now from Sturgeon Lake in Alberta, Canada, is Sheldon Sunshine. He is the chief of Sturgeon Lake Cree Nation. Chief Sunshine, good morning and welcome to Native America Calling.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. Joining us from Edmonton, Alberta, in Canada, also is Matthew Wildcat. He is an assistant professor and director of Indigenous governance in the Faculty of Native Studies at the University of Alberta. He's a member of the Irminskin Cree Nation. He's been on the show before. Matt, good morning and welcome back to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me back.
Chief Sunshine, I want to begin with you. You and another First Nations chief wrote a joint cease and desist letter to Alberta Premier Danielle Smith. And in the letter, you state the premier is attempting to manufacture what you call a national unity crisis by enabling separatists. What is the main issue you have against this talk of a separation of Alberta from the rest of Canada?
Well, I think it's a multitude of things. Over the last few months, there's been a lot of talk, and then leading up to, of course, this Bill 54, where they're trying to reduce the requirement to host a referendum in which they'll propose separation. This is from all intents and purposes, I guess. And, you know, when we're dealing with the provincial government and all of their these things that they've been doing, like there's other issues that we're facing. Like we live in crisis in our communities, whether it's the housing crisis or unemployment or the opioid crisis, you know, and it all leads back to poverty. And when you're talking about separating and the intent to separate, it really upsets myself and other leaders, right? As you've seen all across the country, we've had a lot of feedback in support of our letter that we put out to the premier, and it's, like I said, it's frustrating, but all of those other issues are not even discussed. You're talking about those types of things, right?
What are you hearing from Premier Smith, and what type of communication do you and other First Nation governments have with her office?
I haven't heard anything from that office, really, other than what they provide in the news reports. We're going to be seeking a meeting discussing some of these issues, like like I said, we live in crisis. There's the healthcare issues, education issues that they're having within their government. So we want to have a frank discussion about how these things are impacting our people.
Now, in the letter, you remind the premier that Alberta is on treaty lands. Provincial authorities, how responsive are they to their obligations under the treaties?
I would say they try not to be responsible, period. There is, when they talk about Alberta being rich, and you know, I think last year there was $30 billion that came into Alberta through royalty and taxes, and not much of that even comes to First Nation unless you're applying for some specific funding from the province. So, you know, when they're talking about rich in resource, those are really First Nations resources. And it's time that they sit down and talk about those and sharing. When we signed Treaty in 1899 and Treaty 8, that was one of the understandings. We're going to share the land. And, we haven't seen it.
Do you know offhand about how many First Nations communities, governments there are in Alberta? It would help put some perspective to our listeners, most of whom are in the States. And I'm curious, because I imagine that these groups have different needs, they have different agendas. How can the tribe sustain a unified voice on this issue in Alberta?
I believe there's 44 to 46 nations in Alberta. That's not including the Métis groups, and I think with this type of rhetoric and discussion that a lot of the nations come together and really are behind this this position.
How serious is this? I mean, could this really happen? Because I think that's what a lot of people are sitting here just kind of wondering. Well, you know, we hear a lot of rhetoric, we hear a lot of talk, but how likely could this actually materialize and become a reality?
Well, just based on the Supreme Court of Canada decision on the last separation, they have to come through First Nation to get First Nation support, and they're not going to get it. So based on the law, I don't think it'll go anywhere, but it is creating that discussion for no reason while we have so many other things to be worried about. And it's unfortunate that it's got to this point. It seems like that they're just trying to keep a small sect happy, have them have their voice. And, you know, it's unfortunate.
Now, I did read some information with regard to they did some polls with regard to people in Alberta and what their viewpoint is, whether or not they support this idea of separation. But what are you hearing? And I'm thinking specifically of non-First Nations people there in surrounding communities and across the province. What's their thought? Do they support this idea?
I've had a lot of feedback from the average citizen in Alberta, even average citizens across Canada, numerous emails on both sides. They're supporting separation, and the majority of them are not supporting that separation discussion. But I think for the most part, the support is not to separate, that I've been getting from the average citizen anyway.
About how much of Alberta is treaty territory?
The treaties cover the entire Alberta. There's Treaty 6, 7, and 8, and there's a section of Treaty 10 on the Saskatchewan-Alberta border.
Okay. And one thing I noticed you made clear in your letter is that these treaties, they predate before Alberta was even made a province. And that's part of your issue as well, is that these treaties were established long before Alberta even existed.
That is correct. It was, like I said, our Treaty 6, 7, and 8 were signed in 1876, 1877, and 1899, and Alberta became a province in 1905. So they're not even, like, they talk about sovereignty. They initiated a Sovereignty Act, trying to be recognized as sovereign, but they're not.
And what about relations with previous premiers there in Alberta? Have they been contentious as well, or have there been better relationships in the past?
I can't really speak to any relationship previous. I've been chief for 3 years now, and Daniel Smith is the only premier that I've known, right, in this position. Prior to that, I really didn't pay attention to provincial politics.
Mm-hmm. What would you like to see there, not just in Alberta, but across Canada, to ensure that treaty rights are better affirmed?
What I would like to see is that the federal and provincial governments sit down with First Nation leaders, First Nation people, to discuss what that relationship is. You know, there's unfinished treaty business, treaty obligations, you know, and there's an understanding from when our people sign treaty, and opposed to what they have written down in treaty text. As you know, history favors the one who documents it, right? So we have an understanding of what we agreed to under treaty, and they go by what's written in the text, you know. And one of those key items is the cede and surrender, and we maintain that we have never ceded or surrender. You know, we go back to our creation stories, where part of our creation story is we are part of the land. We're spiritual part of the land, and we would never give up a piece of us. So I think what I'd like for this is to have a clear and open discussion with both governments, and really finishing up this treaty business so that we can move forward.
Mm-hmm. We got about a minute before we have to go to our first break. How successful have you been at having government officials understand your concerns over these potential treaty violations?
I think it's been an ongoing battle for leadership in our positions, and it's. But I think more and more that people are finally realizing that it's time that we take a stand, such as this letter and those type of things, to start really pushing to get that discussion going.
Chief Sunshine of the Sturgeon Lake Cree Nation, Chief Sheldon Sunshine, kicking off our conversation here today on Native America Calling, talking about an issue there with regard to the idea of Alberta separating from the rest of Canada. Chief Sunshine, thank you for your time. I understand you've got other things you've got to do today, so thank you again for joining us.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Absolutely. We're going to take a short break. We're going to come back, and we've got the phone lines open for anyone who would like to join the conversation. 1-800-99-NATIVE. President Trump has indicated his intention to do away with the institutions that help facilitate funding for affordable housing, small businesses, and other community development projects on tribal land. We'll find out what the potential loss of these financial institutions means, especially for rural areas, on the next Native America Calling.
Support from Dartmouth College, hosting its Tribal Leadership Academy July 28th to August 2nd in New Hampshire. Up to 25 new or appointed tribal government leaders and a group of experienced presenters will consider intergovernmental relations, economic development, healthcare, natural resources, and tribal law and order. Dartmouth College will cover the travel and attendance costs. Application available at dartmouthtriballeadershipacademy.com. Application deadline is May 16th, 2025. Hey,
Ohio. Mantunita humala, hey metawala, hungamu.
Thanks for tuning in today to Native America Calling. Talk in Alberta about separating from Canada has sovereignty and treaty implications for the Indigenous people who live there. First Nations leaders have expressed their strong opposition to the idea. We're hearing from some of those voices today. What implications does talk about Canada breaking up have on the United States? Join the conversation by calling in at 1-800-996-2848. That's 1-800-99-NATIVE. Let's hear now from Chief Wilton Littlechild on the calls for Alberta to separate from Canada. Chief Littlechild is a Canadian lawyer and Cree chief who served as Grand Chief of Confederacy of Treaty 6 First Nation. He is from the Ermineskin Cree Nation. Here he is talking about the possible implications for First Nations if Alberta moves forward with separation.
Well, one of the first implications I want to find out about is what is going to be their exit plan. What is the plan to exit Canada? Because I think it'll call into question the economic impact of separation, and I don't think it can happen overnight. It's going to take quite some time for them to design an exit strategy, and they can't do it without us. It's kind of, you flip the coin, we're deciding to leave, and we say, okay, if you decide to leave, here's the conditions on which you're going to leave. In fact, it's our eviction order. You know what I mean? It's there's two sides to the coin. And I want to see an exit strategy. I want to see an economic analysis done in terms of the impact. And, of course, just a whole legal reorganization of that kind of a situation going forward. What does it become? Does it become in its own nation status? Does it become a 51st state of the United States, or, you know, that discussion going on? There's a lot of questions in the air that would have to be clarified or answered before this can move forward.
Are you seeing any type of trend with Alberta's non-Native residents and this issue of separatism? Do you see this unfolding in a certain way?
Yes, I do. In fact, last week there has been several calls of support to the chiefs of Alberta, what's called Alberta. Treaty 6, 7, and 8 chiefs have been very, very clear in making a statement that they will not stand by and let this happen. And there's been some expressed support from across the country to the chiefs here. And that's a good trend in the sense of us getting together. It's unifying us in a good, strong way. So I think that if you can call it a trend, I think it's really a movement to support each other whenever treaty territory is going to be challenged like that.
That was an interview NAC producer Sol Traverso did with Chief Wilton Littlechild earlier today. Let's go to Matthew Wildcat for his assessment of Chief Littlechild's comments. And again, Matthew is an assistant professor and director of Indigenous Governance in the Faculty of Native Studies at the University of Alberta. Matthew, what do you make of Chief Littlechild's assessment that this will not happen overnight?
Yeah, well, it's good to hear. So, yeah, Chief Littlechild is my parents' neighbor out in Muscogee's on Ermineskin Reserve. And as usual, he's being very diplomatic and extremely generous with even entertaining the idea that this is a possibility, right? And so I think what I really take away from his comments and just to highlight for people is that, you know, the sovereignty held by treaty people exceeds the sovereignty of Canada, right? So Canada can't just dictate to treaty peoples what they have to do or follow, but rather because our sovereignties exceed that of the Canada and the British Crown and Alberta, that these things have to be negotiated. Right. And so, I think what Chief Littlechild is saying there is like, well, if you can't take this move unilaterally, in fact, you can't even take this move by just being on good terms or good relationships with treaty people, treaty nations in Alberta. You can only undertake it if you've come to discuss with us, you know, what that might look like, and then we lay out the conditions for you under which you could possibly even do that, right? And so so that's the, I think, is the big thing that we should understand from Chief Littlechild's comments.
Matthew, this Alberta separation proposal, did you see this coming, or was it a big surprise for you?
Well, yeah, no, you've seen it coming for a while now, I think. You know, so Danielle Smith has now had a number of interactions or she's done a number of things which have caused the ire of First Nations. And one of those was there already was a sovereignty act that was put in place, right? And so, you know, when she, when they passed that piece of legislation in the Alberta legislature, you know, the point of it was is to put Alberta in a more advantageous position in regards to the rest of Canada when it came to dealing with you know, intergovernmental relations. And so, the whole point of that was for Alberta to feel like it could flex its authority more than it could in the current political climate. Right. And so, you know, if you go back to that, I believe it was in the December of 2022 or the fall of 2022 is how it all, when all of that unfolded. And, you know, it has the hallmarks of what she's trying to do now. And, you know, of course, the premier is not saying that she wants to separate. In fact, she is saying she will fight against separation, but she is also enabling the possibility of a vote.
She's making it easier for citizens to have a referendum. Is that correct?
She's making it easier for citizens to have a referendum in a legal sense. But the other, you know, I think the other piece that she's doing are, you know, kind of what her public comments have said. She said there's so much frustration and discontentment in Alberta about the actions of the federal government that, you know, she's like, if I don't give a release valve to all of these separatist frustrations and anxieties, it's going to boil over into something else. And so to her mind, she's like, you know, this is something that we need to do because we need to talk about this issue. People need to get it off their chest, so to speak, right? But at the same point, it's a very dangerous proposition, I think, to entertain the idea, even if you don't think it's possible. And the fact of the matter is it's probably incredibly unlikely that this will happen. But even entertaining the idea can have repercussions that we don't know about, right? And, you know, one of my colleagues here at the university, in his public commentary on the issue, said, you know, this idea that, oh, we need to, let's have a referendum, let people hash it out in public, we'll get it off our chest, and then we, you know, we won't have to worry about it, again, was the exact same strategy that the British Prime Minister used during Brexit, right? You know, you have this kind of like, you know, it was, you know, frankly, an anti-immigrant, oftentimes, racist, but, you know, also very protectionist, and kind of trying to hold on to like an old white sense of like British nationalism that was like, you know, it was significant, but it wasn't a majority by any sense, right? And so the British Prime Minister is like, okay, let's have a referendum, we'll just settle it once and for all. But then of course what happens is the Leave campaign mounted an incredible strategy. They were really able to connect with people and frankly to flare up a bunch of fears and frustrations in folks. And then all of a sudden they're winning this very close campaign when no one thought it was possible because, you know, of course it has led to significant economic repercussions for you know, Britain to withdraw from the EU and causes all these ripple effects because you allowed a small minority to gain steam and momentum by taking it seriously, right? And so, you know, so there's no guarantee that putting this to a referendum and talking about it in a serious way will lead to people realizing that we need to stay, or like that Alberta needs to stay as part of Canada. It's equally as likely that you give life and momentum and energy to a group of people who are now small but will get bigger because they're allowed to refine their thinking and their rhetoric and their talking points and connect with people, and to have a bunch of people have to take it more seriously. You don't know what, you know, what the outcome of that is, right? And so we shouldn't think of that this is a doing something like this is, we'll do it, we'll get it done, and it will be clear and obvious that people don't want to do this at the end of it, right? You know, again, I think right now the polling I've heard, but this is, you know, a week old now, is that about 25% of Albertans think separating is a good idea, or that they would be willing to entertain it. You know, even if that got to 40%, that's still a bad number. That's going in the wrong direction, right? And so I don't think that there's any case to be made from Danielle Smith of like, this is something that will be good for us because it'll let us like, we'll debate it and then we'll be able to move on from it, right? It's equally as true that we could debate it and then it becomes a permanent feature of Alberta politics, or at least for, you know, the medium term.
Matthew, you describe this as a small group, but it has the potential to grow. It could become a larger movement. How much of this, in your view, is being influenced by what's happening here in the States and the new presidential administration of Donald Trump?
Well, it certainly has an impact there. You know, I'm just looking through the headlines this morning. There was an opinion columnist with the Calgary Herald who said that Albertans think that that their biggest fear is not Donald Trump. Their biggest fear is another Liberal NDP coalition in the federal government, right? And you know, he goes on to make the case that, you know, in Ontario, whatever anxieties you have about Donald Trump and what he's doing, that's the same way that we feel, you know, in Alberta here, that's the same way that we, you know, he's not, of course, talking about all of Alberta, but, you know, a certain segment of Alberta. That's the same way people feel about a Liberal government, right? And so, you know, is it having a direct impact? It's hard to say, but it's definitely having an impact because it's changing the political landscape that we exist in and the way in which people prioritize issues, right? It's also, I think, you know, maybe what I'm trying to get at here is that it's creating an atmosphere of uncertainty around all sorts of things, right? Like, I think this is maybe one of the defining things of the Donald Trump presidency, the second term in particular, is that no one knows what's going to happen next. And so, I think that general uncertainty that's being created is making people, you know, it's changing their political calculus of, you know, what they should prioritize or focus on. And in Alberta, I think, you know, part of what's happening is the way in which, you know, a certain segment of Alberta is receiving this anxiety is that we should separate, we should be on our own, right? And so it would be hard-pressed for me to believe that Donald Trump isn't contributing to this atmosphere in some sort of way.
Matthew, the last time we had you on the show, we talked about former Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, his exit and his relationship with Indigenous people there in Canada. What do you expect now from this new Prime Minister, Mark Carney?
Almost certainly Indigenous issues will probably drop in their priority would be my guess. Like, the Prime Minister has signaled and is now acting upon in the creation of his, you know, his new cabinet. He just appointed ministers this morning. That the main focus is on dealing with the relationship with the United States, right? And so, you know, there's only ever so much room on people's plate in terms of priorities that they can have. And, you know, Justin Trudeau was not perfect by any stretch of the imagination when it came to Indigenous issues. Most certainly overpromised. I think he was early on in his term, like, you know, 2015, was not able to grapple with the complexity of the issue and thought that, you know, he could wave a magic wand. You know, at the same time, they have a couple key pieces of legislation that they were passed, especially around the inherent jurisdiction that First Nations have around child welfare. And, you know, again, none of these things are perfect, but it was certainly something that was, you know, part of his priorities, right? And so, you know, probably that's going to go away. Hopefully, you know, there are some couple, you know, there's negotiation on a number of different fronts, but certainly there's, you know, funding for children's services or child welfare. You know, hopefully that gets picked up, and they had carved out monies within the budget to negotiate a final deal. I know Ontario is going ahead with that, and so hopefully that can apply to the rest of Canada. You know, I know there had been other set-asides to deal with historic grievances. You know, and there was in Treaties 4, 5, and 6, this is something Treaty 8 had already negotiated. People call it cows and plows, but there was, you know, historical provisions made for the allowance of agricultural implements to allow people to get farms started up, and those were never satisfied. You know, these kind of very specific, you know, obligations that the treaty detailed out. And, you know, there's money set aside for that. And, you know, hopefully those deals can be, you know, people have differing opinions on whether it's worth to negotiate those deals or not. But certainly there's money there for First Nations who do wish to, you know, to resolve that historic grievance over the provision of agricultural implements. And so, you know, we'll see if some of those things can continue forward, but it's really, I think, much less likely that Prime Minister Carney will have it top of mind.
Matthew, we have about a minute before we have to take another break. What more can you tell us about Prime Minister Mark Carney? I think I read that he spent part of his childhood in the Northwest Territories, up near Fort Smith.
Yeah, he's from Fort Smith. I know there's certainly some. His father was involved in Indigenous education, you know, First Nation education, and I forget what the headline is, but you know, his father had made some very disturbing comments in the past. But I also know that his father had written a report detailing some of the horrors that happened at residential schools. But I also had just from, you know, being around here at U of A, I'd had a faculty member who was phoned up by an elder, Marilyn Buffalo, and Marilyn was talking about her relationship with the former prime minister's father, saying they used to play volleyball together. And so, you know, I think certainly there's at least some familiarity with Indigenous issues.
All right, we're going to take another break, and we're going to come back and continue our conversation. We have another guest lined up for you, and the phone lines are still open. So if anybody who would like to join this conversation, maybe you spend some time up in Canada, maybe you have relatives or family in Canada, maybe you visit Canada periodically, maybe you go up to Alberta every once in a while. Let us know, 1-800-996-2848.
Support provided by Amerind. Amerind is 100% tribally owned and partners with tribes and their businesses to provide affordable commercial insurance coverage, protect tribal sovereignty, and strengthen Native American communities by helping to keep dollars in Indian country. Information about property, liability, commercial auto, and workers' comp available at Amerind.com. That's Amerind.com.
Did you know that one person can save up to 8 lives and heal dozens more through the gift of organ and tissue donation? Give hope to thousands of people across the U.S. waiting for a life-saving organ transplant. Learn more about the power of organ, eye, and tissue donation with Life Center Northwest, the organ procurement organization serving all of Alaska, at lcnw.org. That's lcnw.org.
Support provided by Amerind. Amerind is 100% tribally owned and partners with tribes and their businesses to provide affordable commercial insurance coverage, protect tribal sovereignty, and strengthen Native American communities by helping to keep dollars in Indian country. Information about property, liability,
commercial auto, and workers' comp available at Amerind.com. That's AMERIND.com.
Support provided by Alaska Growth Capital. The Aleut Marketplace is now open. Aleut Corporation shareholders and registered descendants are eligible. Applications are available at alaskagrowth.com under Marketplace. Support for this program provided by ConocoPhillips Alaska, operating in Alaska for more than 50 years and valuing the opportunity to partner with Alaska Native communities.
We're glad you've joined us today on Native America Calling. We're going to stay in Canada for the remainder of the show and get some perspective on the new Pope. Pope Leo follows Pope Francis, who reached out to Canada's Indigenous people, including an apology for past residential school abuses. Of course, you can still join our conversation by calling in at 1-800-996-2848. That's 1-800-99-NATIVE. Joining us now from Long Beach, California, is Steve Newcomb. He is the author of Pagans in the Promised Land, Decoding the Doctrine of Christian Discovery, and co-founder and director of the Indigenous Law Institute. He is Shawnee and Lenape. Good morning, Steve, and welcome back to Native America Calling.
Good to be with you. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Well, we definitely want to talk about the Pope, but I'd just like to get your perspective here on what we've been talking about with regard to what's going on in Alberta. And I know you've been on the show before, and you told us that Canada has no problem violating its treaties with First Nations. If this separation moves forward, what is the future of federal treaties there in Canada, and maybe even here in the U.S. as well?
Well, that's probably better for someone within that context of the Canadian system to respond to. But the thing that I always focus on is the claim of a right of domination, meaning the claim of Crown sovereignty with regard to Turtle Island and that whole history, the trajectory of that initial claim made by various monarchs, monarchies from Christendom, and how that legacy continues to this day. And I think that with regard to the new papacy of Pope Leo XIV, that it provides us with an opportunity to deeply examine, even more thoroughly than we have up to this point, the relationship between the Catholic Church, the Roman Catholic Church, and this Turtle Island continent and other parts of the hemisphere and elsewhere in the world. So the way I contextualize it is to always begin with our original free and independent existence, extending back to the beginning of time through our oral histories and oral traditions, and then the contrast of that free existence with the system of domination that was brought by ship across the ocean and imposed on everyone and everything. And that takes us back to those initial Vatican papal documents from the 15th century that express those patterns of domination and the claim of a right of domination in regard to our nations and peoples.
All right. Well, let's hear again from Chief Wilton Littlechild. Chief Littlechild was part of an Indigenous delegation that traveled to the Vatican in 2022 to ask an apology from the late Pope Francis for the Church's role in residential schools. He also gifted Pope Francis a headdress. Here's Chief Littlechild speaking about the next steps in reconciliation between the Catholic Church and Indigenous peoples.
The next step, in a way, is an ongoing step in terms of walking together. We started on a path toward reconciliation, and one asks, well, what does that look like? What does reconciliation mean? What does it look like? When do we know we have reconciliation? And those are difficult but good questions. So we're on this journey now of walking together, both Indigenous and non-Indigenous peoples, with the effort of trying to, I guess, bring to reality that peaceful coexistence I was talking about, but also just to make things right. And reconciliation really starts with oneself. You have to reconcile yourself with Creator to then turn to your own family, in a sense. We've had to do, you know, to reconcile with your own family and heal the harms of families in our communities. And then start working together with neighbors. How do we develop a better relationship with our neighbors? And yes, it's a healing journey. Yes, it takes a lot of effort. But really, how do we restore respectful relationships? And that restoring of respectful relationships is what we seek to do by on this path of reconciliation. It's healing. It's a call to work together. And it's to restore good relationships. We're called to do that, by the way, in our own treaties. We have treaties number 6, for example, which is a peace and goodwill treaty. And when you assault that relationship of peaceful peace treaty, that concerns me to go back to our first discussion in terms of separation. So it's all wrapped up in one bundle, I guess, an indigenous lens on things, I would say. We have a treaty. It's about peace and friendship. That is actually what reconciliation is and is about. And then when that's challenged, concern is then how do we resolve that situation using whatever we can, whether it's international law, whether it's prayer, it's efforts together. It's all wrapped up in one bundle, I think, as I see it. And then when a new pope establishes a foundation for us to work on peace, I think that's all part of the reconciliation journey.
And what type of dialogue would you like to have with Pope Leo? And would you like to see an apology from him as well?
I don't think so. I think we've had an expression of apologies, I'll say, because it wasn't only the Catholic faith that was involved here. There are other faith groups, the other churches that have actually expressed apologies as well. But I guess to have an apology is one step. When you have an apology expressed, then you have to consider, do I forgive for that past? For example, the abuses that we heard about, the physical abuse, the mental abuse, the cultural, spiritual abuse, and worst of all, sexual abuse. And through that, you have an opportunity calling for an apology to forgive. And the power of forgiveness is really about freedom, in a sense. I think that if we can move on from, yes, now that we know the truth of what happened, how do we then fix that harm that was done? How do we encourage healing through considerations and ways that we have either traditionally to go forward and bring about those good relations and healing relations? So it's stepping from the harm and knowing full well some people are still not to a place of forgiveness. Some say, I'll never forgive anyone for what they did to me as a child. But when I hear that sentiment, I usually ask people, but please don't take it out on your family. Because in some cases, that's what was happening. So it's a cycle that sort of has been broken now. And the way forward is to keep working on this path of reconciliation, however it looks to these different circumstances. But let's move on from the past, in a sense, in a good way. And I know it's harsh to say that, but we need to be able to forgive someone when they apologize, because that sets you on a path to healing.
Reconciliation. Keep hearing that word again and again, reconciliation. Steve, what are your thoughts on that word? What does it mean to you, reconciliation? What do you see for future relations between the church and indigenous people?
Well, I think they have to come to terms with their past as a church and an institution that issued documents of domination centuries ago, and those patterns of domination are ongoing. In terms of restoring, how do you restore something that never existed to begin with? If I have a falling out with my wife, I can reconcile with her because we had a beneficial, loving relationship to begin with, so maybe we can patch things up. But if you never had that to begin with, how do you restore something you never had? It doesn't even begin to make sense. And so the idea of reconciliation, that is a Catholic term, and usually reconcile yourself to Christ and that sort of terminology.
But when you have an ongoing system of domination that's used against our nations and peoples and has been for centuries, and they haven't stopped that system of domination, it's premature to have any kind of conversation about, and probably nonsensical to have any conversation about something called reconciliation. Have them stop the claim of a right of domination, end that. And then with regard to the restoration and repair of our languages, cultures, spiritual traditions, all the things that they have worked so dutifully to destroy through all their various patterns over generations, how in the world do you repair those things? And so, you know, I think that is just a different kind of orientation that Wilton Littlechild is expressing there, but it's certainly not my orientation, nor the traditional people that I associate with.
Steve, you're one of the leading scholars on the doctrine of discovery, or as you call it, the doctrine of domination. What would you like to see from Pope Leo XIV to take further action or to address this doctrine of discovery in the church's role in colonialism?
Well, I think that we need to have the conversation about the things I've already mentioned, and we are intending to travel to the Vatican this October, assuming everything comes together as it seems like it may, and begin to have some additional conversations that we've already had many of those conversations in the past, but continue that conversation and actually show our doctrine of discovery, unmasking the domination code documentary to the Vatican officials there. Hopefully the Pope, Pope Leo XIV, would attend as well. But regardless, we want to have that deeper conversation about why is it that the global system on the planet is organized around the claim of a right of domination that needs to end and to no longer be perpetuated. And I think our traditional languages and cultures are original instructions of having a sacred regard for all living things and viewing everything as related and as relatives is a remedy, an antidote, so to speak, for that idea of having domination over others and over all existence, and you know, maximizing profits for corporations, no matter how ruthlessly, as Elon Musk put it some time ago. And so I think that's the conversation we're going to continue to have with them. And it's, I think, a step in the right direction for sure.
Pope Leo is the first Augustinian friar to be elected pope. He's also the first pope from North America. He grew up in Chicago. He has Creole roots from Louisiana. Steve, how big of an influence do you think some of those factors could be with regard to how he'll go about making decisions and his relationships with indigenous people?
Well, it's time will tell. Pardon me. Apparently, he has deep ties to indigenous communities in Peru, and I don't know enough about his overall record to be able to speak to it at this moment, but from what I've looked at so far, it indicates that he intends perhaps to continue the type of orientation that Pope Francis had with regard to indigenous peoples' issues and so forth. I think you know, that's a checkered record in terms of the Pope, the prior Pope Francis, having given sainthood to Junipero Serra, the head of a horrifically destructive mission system in California. That's certainly not something that people ought to look at favorably. On the other hand, you know, he did travel to Canada and interact with indigenous peoples in Canada, and he did extend his hand to those of us that went to the Vatican in 2016, and he also met with the delegation from the Canadian context, you know, not that long ago. So I think if Pope Leo is willing to continue that in that on that trajectory, that would be a good thing. And so time will tell for sure.
And if you're able to meet with Pope Leo, what words would you like to share with him?
I will say to him the same thing that I said to Pope Francis. We're calling on you to formally revoke the Intercessitera Papal Bull of May 4th, 1493, to lift the darkness that the Vatican imposed on our peoples. And that's what we've been saying ever since Virgil Kilstrate and I began this effort in 1992 to call upon the papacy to formally revoke that papal bull as representative of the whole series of documents that express a claim of a right of domination. That's what we will continue to do going forward. And doing that with the idea that we want to see right and respectful relations in the world between all peoples and to see a beneficial way of life on behalf of all life and all creation, you know.
Mm-hmm. What do you think? Do you think there's a possibility that you would get a chance to meet with Pope Francis here in the next few years?
I think it's very likely in October, as I said, if our trip comes together in the way that it looks like it may, there's a very strong likelihood, and we intend to meet with the dicasteries, the two dicasteries that issued the statement said to be a repudiation of the doctrine of discovery that came out of May 30th of 2023, I think it was. We want to meet with those folks, and you know, it's so interesting to look at the intricacies of that document, because they're saying that the monarchs manipulated the papal bulls, but really that it suggests that they were attempting to use it in a manner not intended. And so, in other words, the using it for a purpose other than how it was originally supposed to be used, but that's a mistaken notion. So we're looking forward to those conversations, and the main thing is we need to deal with the Johnson versus McIntosh ruling and the fact that the organic law of the United States is based upon the papal documents of the 15th century. So thank you very much for having me. I appreciate the opportunity.
Thank you, Steve Newcomb, along with our other guests, Sheldon Sunshine, Matthew Wildcat, and Wilton Littlechild. That's it. We're out of time for today, but we'll be back again tomorrow with a conversation about the potential blow from the Trump administration's cuts to Native community development financial institutions. Until then, enjoy the rest of your day. I'm Sean Spruce.
Program support by AmeriCorps Vista, where you can kickstart your career and help others in your community. With AmeriCorps Vista, you can serve in an office setting and address issues of poverty while gaining career experience and building your leadership skills. Learn more by visiting AmeriCorps.gov/Vista today. That's AmeriCorps.gov/VISTA. Support for this program is provided by AARP. AARP creates and connects people to unique tools and programs, helps conserve personal resources, and tackles the issues that matter most to individuals, families, and communities. What AARP does might surprise people. For more information and resources, including member benefits, AARP advocacy, and more, go to aarp.org.
Native America Calling is produced in the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kwanic Broadcast Corporation, a Native nonprofit media organization. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting with support from the Public Radio Satellite Service.
Fiber Plus Internet is now available in Sandpoint and King Cove. GCI offers high-speed internet in your community at the same plans and pricing as in Anchorage. More information is available at gci.com/internet.
Black girl, black girl, sleepless night in a pine, in a pine. Oh, while the sun never shine, I wish you would hold on to. Fly girl, where will you go? I'm gone, but a cold wind blows. In the pine, in the pine, while the sun never shines, I wish you would.